Right, brethren, today we're beginning a new short season of Bible studies. It's not too long from now, in fact, to the Feast of Tabernacles. I think 3 weeks' time is the Feast of Trumpets, so obviously no Bible study on that date, so I'm not starting anything too lengthy. Today's study probably will be probably two-part, maybe possibly a three-part, but certainly a two-part, and a topic that I think is fairly important. Now, in the past, we have discussed the question of faith. And we know that faith is talking about walking by faith and not by sight, the danger being that if you're looking at faith, then if you start looking at what you see, what you touch, what you can hear, what you feel, you'll be often swayed away from what God's promises say. And the reason is because you and I are physical. We are material, we are flesh and blood, we drive by sight, we walk down the road by sight, we watch the TV by sight, and our five physical senses are very, very important. And all we've said in the past is that's great, God gave us those five senses for that reason, but when it comes to walking by faith, often we're looking at things that are not seen. And that means looking at them with the eye of faith and seeing the invisible. Well, there's another aspect to this, which is that whilst it's normal to walk by sight, normal to rely on what we see and hear, if we're so focused on the physical, we can actually lose sight entirely, if we're not careful, of the world of the spirit. And that can present you with a risk, that can present me with a risk, since there is potential danger for us in the spirit world. So if we are always looking at purely what we can see and hear and touch and feel and taste, if we forget that there is an invisible spirit realm and that we have an invisible enemy, a real enemy, an active enemy, well, if we ignore that, we're foolish. We're definitely at risk, because you and I cannot afford to ignore Satan and his operations, and we shouldn't. Of course, on the other hand, it's equally foolish to get so wrapped up in the spirit realm and the occult and necromancy and things of that nature that you end up going to the opposite extreme. We're talking about being balanced, but the scripture tells us sufficient about the spirit realm, and for a very good reason. So I'd like to review over the next couple of weeks or so what scripture tells us about Satan, about the fallen angels, about demons, and what we need to know about that realm, and of course what we need to do about it. And today's message is entitled Our Adversary the Devil. Our adversary, the devil. And let's first of all look at a few scriptures that just tell us point blank that you and I do literally have a real enemy. It's not made up. It's not designed to scare little children. It just happens to be a fact. It is the truth. If we turn to 1 Peter chapter 5, 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. First letter of Peter, chapter 5, and beginning in verse 8. And here we read, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil," today's title, "walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him steadfast in the faith." So a fairly brief little sentence or so there, but it says, you know, I need to be alert, be sober, be vigilant, be alert, be on your toes, be on guard. That's an instruction. Why? Because, said Peter, your adversary, the devil, some translations say your enemy, the devil, walks about. So he's active. He's not in a cave somewhere in Tibet. The devil is walking about. One translation, the NET, says, your enemy, the devil, is on the prowl, like a roaring lion. Well, a lion who roars is probably a hungry lion. And he roars to frighten, to intimidate, to boast. Once he actually finds his prey, of course, he doesn't roar at that point. Usually he's very, very quiet, or she, and sneaks up very quietly, surreptitiously, well hidden, and then, of course, pounces, and then typically breaks the neck of his prey. But a roaring lion is likely to be a dangerous lion if you meet him or her. And it says here, this is Peter, who knew a thing or two. He says, watch out, people. Be on your guard, because your adversary, your enemy, the devil, that's who he is on the prowl, is walking about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And there are some that he may devour, because they don't keep their guard up. They don't remain vigilant and sober. They don't remain watchful. And so they're caught out. The roaring lion gets them. And Peter's saying, he's talking to you. He says, you brethren be sober. You brethren be alert. You brethren be watchful. Because your adversary, brethren, is walking about seeking whom he may devour, which could be some of you, Peter implies, or us today. And so he says, resist him, steadfast in the faith, or one translation says steadfast in your faith. Resist him. What does that mean? Well, it means be alert and resist. If you don't believe the devil's there, or you go from one Sabbath to the next, or one feast to the next, never even think about the devil, other than just the back of your mind somewhere, oh, yeah, Satan, yeah, I know about that. Well, that's not quite what Peter is saying. He's saying, look, people, be on guard. If you're out walking through a jungle somewhere, in Africa, across the fields, and so on, you'd be alert. You'd just wander off, staring at your feet as you go ambling through the brush. If you knew there was a lion loose, or a whole pride of lions out there, you'd be looking quite carefully where you're putting your feet. What's around the next corner, what's that rustling sound in the distance? You'd be alert for a real lion. Well, this lion is more dangerous. This lion can devour saints if they're not alert, if they're not paying attention. So this is not a light. This says, be on your guard. Your enemy, your adversary, your opponent is out there on the prowl, looking, seeking for the ones that he can take out, the ones he can destroy. And it's real. So that's a fairly clear indication there. If we turn to Ephesians chapter 6, book of Ephesians, last chapter, chapter 6 and verse 11. Ephesians 6, verse 11. We won't read all of this section today, but we'll probably come back, I imagine, next week. So picking up in verse 11, Paul, this time, is writing to the brethren in this particular city, and he says, put on the whole armor of God. Now, why would you ever say that? Just to make you look good? Yeah. Oh, I like wearing military uniforms. I look particularly handsome in those, don't you think? Well, no, I don't think Paul's saying, try and look, spectacularly handsome. He says, put on the whole armor of God, because there's danger. There are hazards ahead. There's a risk. He says that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. So put on armor. Now, you know why I put armor on. It's because with armor you may be protected from harm, from danger, particularly if you're in battle. And if you go into battle without armor, then you are highly vulnerable. And so he says, put on this armor so you can stand against the wiles, or my margin says the schemings of the devil. Does that mean the devil schemes? Does he plot? Does he plan? Does he have wiles? Is he trying to take you personally out of the race? Well, he is, and me as well for that matter. And so he says, get your armor in place so you can stand up to the schemings of this spirit being. Verse 12, for we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. We often think we do, but this is who we're wrestling: principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts or armies of wickedness in the heavenly places. Now that's clear. You don't need to do very much in the way of interpretation there. We don't know absolutely what these different ranks are. I believe they're ranks. We'll cover a few bits and pieces later, and scripture doesn't give us everything that probably we'd like to know. I'm personally fairly curious about the spirit world, but we know enough to get on with. We know enough to be aware that there's dangers, and we know enough to know what to do to protect ourselves. We don't know all the ins and outs of the spirit realm, the demons, how different types there might be, and so on. But this indicates here there's probably at least these are four ranks. There are principalities in the spirit realm. There are powers. There are rulers of the darkness of this age. And there are armies of spiritual wickedness in the heavenlies. Absolute details, we don't know. But it tells us there's a variety of forces arrayed against us, because it says we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but we are wrestling against, you know, these four ranks plus probably others. So, is there a battle or not? Is there warfare or not? It says we do not wrestle. Some translations say we do not struggle. Some say fight. Others refer to combat. Well, any way you look at it, you are in a spiritual combat. You're in a spiritual war. You are. Now, you may not think like that. It may rarely cross your mind from one month to the next, in which case maybe not quite as alert as we ought to be, because this is for real. And he says, verse 13, therefore, you see the word therefore, you have to look back and see what it's there for. Because of this spiritual warfare, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. So be prepared to oppose and fight and struggle and engage in combat with these spiritual forces. And wear your armor. And it's foolish, you know, for us to ignore that. Some of these beings here, perhaps the principalities, perhaps the powers, are potentially very, very powerful. We can see one hint back in the book of Daniel, chapter 10. Not all spirits are the same. Not all demons, I suspect, are the same. There are these principalities, these powers, these rulers, these wicked spirits. And look back in Daniel, if I can find it, back in Daniel chapter 10, there's a interesting but rather brief, regrettably, hint at some of the issues that Daniel and God's good angels were facing. Pick up the story in verse 5. And Daniel had a vision, and like many of them, it left him rather sort of weak and certainly very curious about what was it all about. So he was asking God for understanding and for revelation, for understanding and wisdom about this this prophecy he'd seen in vision, and God very kindly sent an answer by an angel. Verse 5, I lifted up my, this is 3 weeks after Daniel had been asking. We can see that a few verses earlier. But I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl. I think beryl tends to be sort of a greenish, perhaps an ochre or a yellow type of colour, shades of blue. So a bit like maybe polished stone. His face like the appearance of lightning. His eyes like torches of fire. His arms and feet like burnished bronze in colour. And the sound of his words like the voice of a great multitude, a crowd of people. This almost certainly is an angel, and probably the angel Gabriel. This angel is not actually named in chapter 10, but Gabriel is named in the earlier chapters, so probably this is Gabriel making a yet another return trip. But quite a dramatic looking being, like polished stone and shining eyes, lightning-like face, and you know, a roaring sound like the sea roaring. I mean, amazing. And Daniel saw the vision, and not surprisingly, he sort of dropped on his face. Verse 10, then suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, "O Daniel, man greatly beloved," which is saying quite something. So that's the message from God through the angel. "Daniel, you're greatly beloved. Anyway, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you." While he was speaking this word to me, I stood trembling, as I guess we might well do. Then he said to me, "Do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard." So the first day you asked, it was heard, and you know, God responded. "And I have come because of your words." Now, this began 21 days earlier. So it's taken 21 days, apparently, for this angel, probably Gabriel, to arrive in the scene. You think, was that a particularly long way? Well, I guess it could be a long way from heaven, but can angels get there a bit quicker? Wasn't it like an express route, that he could have come down? There, why did it take him 3 weeks? Verse 13, "But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. Now, who's the prince of the kingdom of Persia? Just some, you know, overweight guy sitting in a palace in Persia, eating his Snickers bars? Did he keep the angel Gabriel at arm's length for 3 weeks? Don't think so. No, the reference here is to the prince of the kingdom of Persia is another spirit being who would not let Gabriel, if that's who it was, get through to Daniel. In other words, there's a battle in the spirit realm. And Gabriel doesn't just sort of turn up within a matter of minutes after leaving God's presence with the message. 3 weeks have passed. It says here, verse 13, "The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me," that is, opposed me, 21 days, and behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, but we know that Michael is an archangel, says so in the book of Jude. So if Michael's a chief prince, and the opposing agent was the prince of the kingdom of Persia, then yeah, it looks like the prince of the kingdom of Persia is perhaps a slightly lower level angel, spirit being, than Michael. So he says, "Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia." More than one. "Now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision refers to many days yet to come." So he brought this understanding to Daniel. He said to battle with some spirit being or beings for 3 weeks until he was helped out by another angel, Michael. And dropping down to verse 19, and he said, "O man greatly beloved, fear not. Peace be to you. Be strong. Yes, be strong." So when he spoke to me, I was strengthened. I said, "Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me." Then he said, "Do you know why I've come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. So when he leaves Daniel, Gabriel, if that's who it is, has still got some fighting to do in the spirit realm. And it's obviously a fight that, you know, takes time, takes effort, takes support. And when I have gone forth, indeed, the prince of Greece will come. That's bound to be yet another spirit being, a principality ruling over the area or the era of Greece. So details obviously a little bit sketchy, but Paul says that you and I war or wrestle against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darts of this age, against wicked spirits in the heavenlies. There's an example there of even the angels of God having to go into battle. And it takes some time. When we saw there that, you know, it took 21 days, well, there'll be occasions, no doubt, when you and I might ask God for something in prayer, may believe by faith that we receive, but then, you know, nothing's happened within a minute or a day or 10 days. Well, nothing happened for Daniel, but the answer was on his way. He had to get past, if you like, the spirit realm. There was a delay. And I guess looking at that scripture there, are we to assume that these principalities and princes over the nations are no longer there? Was this just applicable in Daniel's day? No, because he said the prince of Greece will come. Is it likely that even today there could be spiritual powers over modern-day Persia, namely Iran? Could there be spiritual powers over Iraq? Could there be spiritual powers over modern-day Assyria, which we believe is Germany? The answer is yeah, very likely. They haven't gone away. There are spirit forces out there. There is a warfare out there. It's possibly bigger than we think. If we turn to James chapter 4. James chapter 4. And verse 7, we've seen Peter, we've seen Paul, now we're seeing James. So they're all giving us pretty much similar story. James chapter 4 and verse 7. Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So, resist. What does that mean? It means you better be aware, first of all, that there is a devil. You better be aware that he's after you. You won't be resisting if you don't think, well, I'm okay. I mean, the devil never turns up here in San Antonio. Never turns up here in, London, Milton Keynes, Birmingham, Newcastle. Never turns up, anywhere, does he? He's not in Missouri or Pennsylvania. It says resist the devil. Well, you need to be aware that the devil is like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. There are principalities and powers and rulers and wicked spirits in the heavenlies, and you and I are in warfare. Hence we better be alert, vigilant, and resist. Now, to resist means to oppose. It means oppose, you know, enter into combat with the devil. And if you do, the encouraging thing is it says that he will flee from you. It's not that, you know, somebody used to joke that I've got the devil on the run, you know, I'm running, he's running after me. That's not quite how it's supposed to look. Putting the devil on the run means that he's running and we're after him, in a sense. It says resist the devil and he will flee from you. I think one translation somewhere says will flee as in fear from you. So one thing we need not be is fearful of the devil, but be vigilant, be alert, be watchful. Don't let him catch us out. We have the armor. We have the commander-in-chief. But we've got to be alert. We can't let our guard down. And if we're unaware that he even is a devil, or if we're unaware that he's actually looking for prey, if we think, you know, we're entirely, totally secure and safe, need not worry about him, well, why is James saying resist him? why is Peter saying, be watchful, be on your guard, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, is on the prowl. We know he's after the world, but he's also after the likes of you and I. And if we're not aware, then of course the devil will take complete advantage of our ignorance or carelessness. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 2. And the devil won't play fair, you know, by the way. It's not Queensbury rules of boxing, you know, 3 minutes and the bell goes. If we're not alert, not vigilant, not aware, then this particular lion will sneak up in the long grass and pounce when we're, you know, half asleep. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, and cutting somewhat into the context, verse 10, this has been in 1 Corinthians. Paul had written about this guy who was with his father's wife, caused all manner of problems in the church. Paul says, you know, get rid of him, you know, disgrace permitting this to exist in your congregation. So of course that was dealt with, and you know, thankfully the man in question had repented and turned round. And now Paul was saying, well, now that's happened, you better welcome this guy and show him real, genuine love. The past is past, it's dealt with. You know, don't allow any animosity, don't be hostile, don't permit any bitterness, because if you do that, you're going to come seriously unstuck. He says, verse 10, now whom you forgive anything, I also forgive, meaning this particular man. For if indeed I have forgiven anything, I have forgiven that one for your sakes in the presence of Christ, lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. He means let's deal with this, because if we don't, Satan will take advantage of us, because we, thankfully, he says, are not ignorant, unaware of his devices. One translation says, not ignorant of his schemes or his purposes. You know, Satan, in a sense, you know pretty much what he's going to do, because he's, you know, in that sense, tends to repeat past successes. And Paul says, we know what Satan's going to do. We know his schemes. We know how he plots. We know his plans. We have insight. We are forewarned. But we need to take this situation under control, lest Satan takes advantage of us. One translation says, lest Satan exploits us, obviously to the destruction of the congregation. Paul meant, if we don't deal with this people, we don't deal with this properly, then we know that Satan will come in, he will exploit the situation, he will take advantage of it, and he will destroy. He will find that he can devour. And that's a warning to the people in Corinth, a warning to you and I today. I mean, in any group of God's people, you'll find a bit of a friction. None of us is perfect. I mean, we all think we are, but shock horror, we're not. And therefore, being human beings, we occasionally, you know, trample on toes. We occasionally say things that are either wrongly said or perhaps misunderstood. So friction, a bit of upset, occasional annoyance is not unheard of among the people of God. But there are times when you think there's more to it than that. There are times when you see situations develop and come to pass that are clearly more than just a few people having a bit of human friction. It's clearly Satan has found an opportunity to take advantage, to exploit, and to destroy. You've maybe seen that.
Yeah.
I think I could say hand in heart, I've seen that in fellowships in recent times, where what's taking place is not just ordinary human interaction. Satan's seen an opportunity and he's come in and he's laid waste. And you see fellowships thereafter splitting and people falling apart, being devoured, and it's because, you know, care wasn't taken to keep Satan at arm's length. Satan is crafty, he is cunning, he knows human nature, he knows human behavior. He's had 6,000 long years to observe and become an expert at interpreting people's you know, language and body language. He's dangerous. If you look at 2 Timothy chapter 2, 2 Timothy chapter 2. All we're establishing so far, hopefully in a few verses, is that Satan is an enemy. He's an adversary. He is not someone, him or his cohorts, that we should just, you know, just ignore and forget all about and assume that, well, I guess the devil and his team are off somewhere in Afghanistan, aren't they? Or perhaps the darkest Africa with witch doctors. Us here in America, us lot here in Britain or Western Europe, we're Christian nations. I mean, the devil wouldn't dare come near our nations because we're just so righteous, aren't we? Well, that'd be foolish. So 2 Timothy chapter 2, beginning verse 24. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth, and that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. There's a couple of different ways of interpreting that last verse, but keeping it simple for today, the hope of good teaching and patience is that certain people may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, the trap of the devil, having been taken captive by him. So there are captives. And it looks like Timothy is being instructed to deal with this situation he'll meet in the church. There'll be people that Timothy will meet who have been taken captive by the devil. They've been snared. They've been caught. They've been overcome. And that's because they will have let their guard down. And it's become evident, maybe it'll be next week, Satan isn't able to just come straight into your life and do things. Satan does not have that ability. He has to have a door opened. He has to have our cooperation. And so here's somebody who has opened themselves up and fallen to a snare, and they've been, it says here, taken captive by Satan. So it's a real battle. There are real victims. Some will be defeated. Some have been defeated, even though scripturally you and I ought always to be more than conquerors. So the scriptures are plain. The devil, the demons, spirits are real, and they do influence mankind. They affect or infect mankind in many different ways. We'll look at a few examples now. Look at Luke chapter 13. Just to repeat that point, they don't have the ability to just step straight in and do things to us. I'd have to wait till next week, but if we do open the door, if we do give them opportunity, they will take it, and it can cause all manner of problems. Next few verses or scriptures we'll look at just show, if you like, a sort of variety of problems brought upon mankind by these spirit forces. Luke chapter 13, and beginning in verse 10. Now he, Jesus, was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. And behold, there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity, 18 years, and was bent over, and could in no way raise herself up. So here's a lady, and it says she has a spirit of infirmity, a spirit of weakness, and actually caused her to be bent over, and she couldn't stand up straight. Now, that sounds pretty uncomfortable. I've seen a few people like that over the years, and it must be very, very difficult to, you know, carry out your normal requirements, getting dressed and visiting the bathroom and so on. This is not good. And for 18 years, she'd been troubled by a spirit of infirmity. So clearly there are some spirits who are linked to infirmity, to weakness. But when Jesus saw her, verse 12, he called her to him and said, "Woman, you are loosed from your infirmity." And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. So fantastic. And the ruler of the synagogue was joyous and shouted, Hallelujah. Now, of course, that's what you'd have hoped. But no, in this particular case, the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation, because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath. So they took great exception to people breaking the Jewish laws of Sabbath keeping, not God's laws. God left it fairly open, but the rabbis and the teachers had created hundreds of laws about what you could or couldn't do on the Sabbath, and if you broke their laws, then of course they get very upset. I think as the Essenes had one law, you couldn't even go to the toilet on the Sabbath because I was doing work. That seemed to me a bit on the extreme side. Well, even if you're a sort of a fan of Judaism, that's a really extreme one. So anyway, the ruler was angry, and he said, because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, and he said to the crowd, there are 6 days in which men ought to work. Therefore, come and be healed on them, and not on the Sabbath day. Hypocrite. The Lord answered him and said, hypocrite. Does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or his donkey from the stall, lead it away to water? You do good for your own animals, looking after them. So ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound, think of it, for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath? So he says, Jesus says, Satan has bound this woman. Now, of course, Satan, in a sense, is responsible. He is, I guess, the one who carries the can for the actions of the various spirit beings under his control. So it's Satan, ultimately. He is the head honcho, the top of the heap. But a particular spirit of infirmity had caused it. And Jesus says, ought not this woman, that's very strong in the Greek, is absolutely necessary for this woman, a daughter of Abraham, think about it, gets loosed from her infirmity and set free from the bonds of Satan. So here's one illustration where spirits affect the health of a person. It may not be popular to think that some ailments and diseases are spiritual in nature, but it's scriptural. If we turn to Mark chapter 9, beginning in verse 17. We were here a few weeks ago, I think, when we were talking about, faith and healing. This is Jesus come down from the mountain of Transfiguration, and he met at the bottom, verse 17. Then one of the multitude answered and said, Teacher, I brought you my son, who has a mute spirit, meaning a spirit that's caused him to be unable to speak. Now, that's quite bad. You live your life and can't communicate without signs and so on. Verse 18, wherever he or it seizes him, he throws him down. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So this particular spirit causes this young boy, as it turns out, to go into what I guess we'd class as an epileptic fit. Stiff, jerking about, foam and froth from the mouth. He can never speak anyway, at any time. So I spoke to your disciples that they should cast him out, but they could not. And he answered him and said, O faithless generation, how long shall I put up with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me. We said before, Jesus wasn't, overly impressed. But I said before, demons cannot just enter. So early in the story here, at some point, the door was opened. We don't know how, of course. But at some point, something had allowed this demon access, because they cannot just barge their way in. Anyway, so Jesus says, bring him to me. Verse 20, they brought him to him. And when he saw him, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. This is the actions of a spirit, causing epilepsy, causing, dumb, unable to speak. So he asked his father, well, how long has this been happening to him? He said, from childhood. Makes you wonder if it was perhaps the parents that opened up the door here. And often he has thrown him both into the fire into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Jesus said to him, well, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. When Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to him, you deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him no more. So Jesus tells us this is a deaf and a dumb spirit. And also he says that he rebuked the unclean spirit. Verse 26, and the spirit cried out, convulsed him greatly, and came out of him, and he became as one dead, so that many said, oh, he is dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. So we learn a few things there. Yep, spirits can cause deafness, can cause dumbness, if there is such a word, can cause epilepsy, and here is referred to as an unclean spirit. Now, I don't know if all spirits are unclean, or whether there are spirits which are unclean and other spirits which are different descriptions. But here is an unclean spirit. And again, at some point, probably in the little boy's childhood, some door had been opened to allow access by the spirit. We turn to Matthew chapter 12 and verse 22. Because nowadays you won't find many hospitals saying, oh, I think there might be a spirit involved in this illness. Because obviously they, by and large, don't believe in the spirit world, spirit realm. Mark having said that, you won't find that in many churches either. I think I mentioned before, when we were in the Birmingham Worldwide Church of God many years ago, there was a young woman who had been married by this time maybe 3 years, something like that. A very nice young girl. Couldn't have been much more than her late 20s, I would have thought. Perhaps, well, no more than her late 20s. Just a little boy, I think, maybe a year or so before. And she became very sort of strange mentally. And her husband was quite concerned. He was in the church as well. And this was a long time back. I was just a young sprog at the time and had limited ability to make any sense of the world. But I was concerned about the couple, did like them very much. They'd been to our home, I think, at least a few times. And my personal view was that she was probably being troubled by a spirit. Seemed most likely to me she'd been perfectly fine in the years we'd known her, and now had become very odd. Her husband was taking her to psychiatrists. She was on various types of drugs for her mind. She had been, for a little while, put away into an asylum, all which I thought was wrong. And talking to her husband, who was a young man, probably no more than 30-odd, I said, have you raised this with somebody in the church? Is your wife perhaps demonized? I couldn't say that. I just said, have you sort of been to the ministry? Oh, yeah. I said, have they sort of discussed anything particular? Well, they said we've got to keep on doing what the doctor says and keep on taking the, all the sort of potions and things. And I think they're going to recommend now, what's it called, the electric shock treatment, which of course is highly dodgy. I said, have they not looked at the ministry, perhaps thinking that there could be, some other reason for this? And he didn't pick up on the point, and I was too diffident to actually sort of say, what about the possibility he's got a demon? And unfortunately, he didn't pick up the point. The ministry never raised it, and this girl continued to suffer at the hand of the psychiatric abusers of the day. Total unwillingness to recognize at least even the possibility that demons could be involved. So it's very strange for Christian people not to recognize that. Anyway, Matthew 12 and 22, and Jesus wasn't surprised. Says here, then one was brought to him who was demon possessed, blind and mute. So I'm reading that as the demon causing the blindness as well as the inability to speak. And Jesus healed him. So the blind and mute man both spoke and saw. so mute, couldn't speak or hear, couldn't see. And all the multitudes were amazed and said, could this be the Son of David? So Jesus is casting out a demon here who can affect your health, can cause you to be a mute, and apparently it was behind the blindness as well. So real demons, real effect on human beings. When the Pharisees heard it, verse 24, they said, this fellow does not cast out demons except by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons. And it goes in their eyes, they saw the demon world as having a ruler, whom they referred to as Beelzebub. And was that just, you know, foolishness in their part? Well, Jesus knew their thoughts and said to them, every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation. Every city or house divided against itself will not stand. If Satan casts out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand? So certainly Jesus is implying here that Satan has a kingdom. And he'd be the king, presumably, of his kingdom. He has spirit beings who report to him. He is their king. Verse 27, and if I cast out demons by Beelzebub, by whom do your sons cast them out? So Jesus pretty much says, well, I'm happy to call him Beelzebub. You've used that name. Happy to endorse that name, Beelzebub. And nobody's too sure exactly what it means. Lord of the flies is one possibility, or Lord of dung, another possibility, or Lord of a place called Zebub. But anyway, you know, Satan is referred to here by Jesus, essentially, as Beelzebub. If I cast out you the demons by Beelzebub, by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore, they shall be your judges. So it's quite evident, you know, that there is this spirit realm. Satan is king of a kingdom, and you know, these individuals who've got demons, you know, Satan is the one behind it. Verse 28, carrying on, if I cast out demons by the Spirit of God, surely the kingdom of God has come upon you. Or else, how can one enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man, and then he will plunder his house? So implying that, you know, Beelzebub, or Satan, is described as a strong man. We turn to Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5. And beginning in verse 1, so that particular demon there was causing blindness and meant to be mute. Here's another effect of a demon or demons or spirits. Then they came to the other side of the sea, verse 1, to the country of the Gadarenes. And when he, Jesus, had come out of the boat, immediately they met him out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one could bind him, not even with chains, because he had often been bound with chains and shackles, and the chains had been pulled apart by him, and his shackles broken in pieces. Neither could anyone tame him. So this man, I think you can see, has supernatural strength because of the unclean spirit that's mentioned here that dwells in him. Because, you know, the locals had tried oftentimes to bring out their, you know, shackles and chains and padlocks and tie him up and try and tie him down to a post or something so he couldn't go wandering off and either harm himself or others. And it did no good. You know, your best, you know, stainless steel shackles, pow, in bits. He just threw them around and off he went. He was wild. You know, the wild man of Borneo, this is the wild man of the Gadarenes. And verse 5, always night and day he was in the mountains, in the tombs, crying out and cutting himself with stones. You know, self-harm. But when Jesus saw him from afar, when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and worshipped him. Interesting in a sense that even though he was clearly very powerfully demonized, the man was still able to overcome that and run, you know, to Jesus. I guess the unclean spirit wouldn't have run to Jesus, but the man had enough. And I guess that's the implication, is that no matter how demonized anyone might be, they could always still come to Jesus. He ran and worshipped him in verse 7, and he cried out with a loud voice and said, "What have I to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God that you do not torment me." For he said to him, "Come out of the man, unclean spirit." So Jesus had taken initiative and said, "Get out of that man, you unclean spirit." And the man, well, the spirit responded, "Don't torment me." Verse 9, then Jesus asked him, "What's your name?" And he answered, saying, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Well, Legion could actually be thousands. But certainly a very large number, apparently, of demons occupied or inhabited this poor man. And the head one, I guess, was Legion. He was the unclean spirit, but plenty of others in there with him. It's hard to imagine, but that's what spirit beings can do. And verse 10, he, Legion, speaking on behalf of his other spirits, begged Jesus earnestly that he would not send them out of the country. And I think the reason is because demons seem to want to be around or in human beings, or like to be in flesh of some sort. They are disembodied. They don't have their own physical bodies. They can't really relate to this world, so they like to be in a body, and they did not want to be sent out of the country. Verse 11, now a large herd of swine was feeding there near the mountains, and all the demons, I guess a whole bunch of them now, begged Jesus, saying, "Send us into the swine, that we may enter them." They did not want to be disembodied. It's a strange thing, but these unclean spirits at least want to be in some flesh and blood. And at once Jesus gave them permission. Then the unclean spirits, plural, went out and entered the swine. There were about 2,000, and the herd, bolted. It ran violently down a steep place into the sea and drowned in the sea. Now those who fed the swine fled and told it in the city and in the country, and they went out to see what it was that had happened. Then they came to Jesus and saw the one who had been demon-possessed and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who saw it told them how it happened to him who had been demon-possessed and about the swine. So there's a indication of what demons can do. They can be large numbers of them. They can make a person supernaturally strong. And the hint here is that they want to be in flesh and blood. They don't like being out in a disembodied state. You can see that sort of further if you look at Luke 11. Matthew, Mark, Luke. Luke 11. And picking up in verse 24. Luke 11:24, when an unclean spirit goes out of a man or a woman, he goes through dry places seeking a rest, wants somewhere to settle down, and finding none, if that is the case, he says, "I will return to my house from which I came." And when he comes, he finds it swept and put in order, and then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there, and the last state of that man or woman is worse than the first. So in other words, when a spirit is disembodied, an unclean spirit, it wants to find somewhere to stay. And if it can't, it wanders about and says, "Tell you what, I'm going back where I was." And it says here it takes with seven other spirits more wicked. So that tells us that spirits are not all the same. They're not all exactly like, off the production line, all identical. This spirit finds seven who are worse than he is and brings them back. Now again, they can't just enter in. We'll cover that next week. And what's possible here is that, maybe this particular person didn't really want this spirit cast out. Maybe it found it fairly easy to get back in. That can happen. They can't barge in. There has to be an opportunity in the first time. But, some people almost enjoy spirits being around them and don't really want to be entirely free I think we mentioned before the Gene Dixon, who was one of America's most famous, what would you call them, soothsayers or psychics. I mean, she's a medium, so I'm being told mediums is a good word, but she allegedly prophesied about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. She allegedly prophesied about the assassination of Robert Kennedy, and indeed even the spot where he was going to be assassinated. She obviously enjoyed having some input from spirit forces. Felt important about it. Of course, she was Roman Catholic. That may have something to do with it. We turn to Acts chapter 16. I read somewhere she was a devout Roman Catholic. It's kind of big, curious, but I suppose it's a fairly wide church. All sorts can be in there. Acts chapter 16. Here's a lady, a young girl, I guess, who was also, at least for a while, quite happy to have a demon. Acts 16 and 16. This took place in the city of Philippi, where the Philippians would have dwelt. Verse 16. Now it happened as we went to prayer, that'd be Luke and Paul and so on, that a certain slave girl possessed with a spirit of divination met us, who brought her master as much profit by fortune telling. So, there are spirits, they can help you tell the future, to a degree. And maybe Gene Dixon had access to some of that. My view's always been that, well, they can't really foretell the future, but what they can do is overhear people's plans. If somebody's planning to assassinate, the Pope, let's say, in a month's time, or a situation like that, well, demons could be around and overhear the conversation. Like, oh, that's interesting, let's follow this a bit further. Now, of course, the demon could easily take that story, that insight, if you like, that knowledge of a plan being put together, and pass it on to a human being. And if somebody has a familiar spirit, that's what would happen. And Gene Dixon may well have had a familiar spirit. Certainly this girl here did. A spirit of divination. The Greek is a spirit of Python, interestingly. Python being, of course, a serpent. But Python being a particular serpent that used to guard the oracle at Delphi, where people went to have their fortunes told. So, an interesting combination there. This girl, verse 17, followed Paul and us, and cried out saying, "These men are servants of the Most High God, who proclaim to us the way of salvation," or perhaps a way of salvation would be better. "And this she did for many days," so don't know how long that is, 2-3 weeks. "But Paul, greatly annoyed, turned and said to the spirit, Marky, not to the girl, I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her. And he, or it, came out that very hour." So, here's another spirit that, if you like, influences and interacts with human beings, this particular spirit, able to help this girl and her masters. Verse 10, I better read that. "When her masters saw that their hope of profit was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace to the authorities." And, trouble ensued. You have to be careful and be prepared for the consequences of standing up for God's way. But the point is that here's a spirit that could give insight to a young girl of a sort of, fortune-telling nature. And equally, this spirit seemed to harass, Paul and his co-workers. And getting harassment, from spirit, demonized people is not, I guess we've all had it. I think most of them probably been in the street or perhaps in a bar or somewhere where just out of the blue some person looks at you and starts shouting at you and accusing you and just pick you out of a group. You think, hang on, what's this all about? I'm just standing here minding my own business, and this person sort of looks at you and starts accusing you, shouting at you. And I was assuming that's just some stupid demon playing sillies, but it happens. And I guess we've all probably had that from time to time. We turn to Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 1. Ephesians chapter 2. Still looking at how spirits, Satan, demons can influence, affect us as human beings, and hence why we need to be alert. verse 1, Paul says, "You he made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked, according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit, who now works in the sons of disobedience." So Paul's talking about the change in our lives, and he mentions that we used to live a particular way, according to the way of the world, according to the prince of the power of the air. Other translations put that as the ruler of the kingdom of the air, or the ruler of the spiritual powers in space. The spirit which now works in, or other translations say the spirit that now energizes the sons of disobedience, or the spirit that now controls the sons of disobedience. So there is out there on the earth in Paul's day, and it hasn't changed today, there is out there the prince, the Greek can mean ruler, commander, or chief. So there is a commander of these spiritual powers who energizes or controls the sons of disobedience. Verse 3, among whom we also once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, and so on. And it's still there. You know, this spirit, this prince of the power of the air, can affect our circumstances to the extent that he can affect people. And if we let our guard down, we might think we're fighting people, but it's not flesh and blood, it's wicked spirits in heavenly places. And that's what you have to deal with. It's real. In fact, there are some spirits who are so dangerous that they've actually been locked away from mankind for the time being. We may have to deal with them later. That's not clear, but let's look at 2 Peter chapter 2. So there are all these principalities, powers, rulers, wicked spirits in heavenly places, unclean spirits, demons. Exactly how the spirit realm is made up, not too sure. We know there's quite a variety there, but apparently some were so bad that they're actually been taken out of circulation for the time being. So 2 Peter and chapter 2, and beginning in verse 4. "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment." So here are angels, and these angels have sinned, and they've been cast down to, it says hell in the English, but the Greek is Tartarus, and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved or kept for future judgment. These particular fallen angels are not on the loose. They are in chains of darkness, and they're in a place called the Tartarus. And verse 5 says, "And did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly." There's a slight hint there, I'll say no more than that, that this may be something that happened just before the flood, this particular incident. But what is clear is that these angels who sinned have been cast down to Tartarus. Now, to most of us, Tartarus means very little. If you're a classical Greek scholar, it means a bit more. And if you lived in Peter's day, it meant a lot more, because Tartarus was a well-known place to Greeks and the Jewish people in those days, and Romans, because Tartarus is where, in Greek mythology, the gods imprisoned those who rebelled against them. So if you take this as being angels who rebelled against God, which is clearly what did happen, angels who sinned, they rebelled against God, then in Greek mythology, if you rebelled against the Greek gods, you were imprisoned in chains in a place that they called Tartarus. And that's where the Titans were imprisoned, and quite a few others. It was a really, really, really deep, dark place. And so Peter says there are angels who rebelled against God, and they're chained up in a place like Tartarus, you know, deep, way out of sight. We turn to Jude chapter 1. It's the only one. Jude one and only chapter, and picking up in verse 6. Jude 6 and 7, it says, the angels who did not keep their proper domain but left their own habitation, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day, as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them in similar manner to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. But verse 6 tells us that these angels who left where they should have been have been reserved in everlasting, that's a long age, in these chains under darkness for judgment of the great day. So these particular angels are not free to roam the earth at the moment. Now they might be, I'll just hint at that in a bit, it's mildly speculative, but it's possible. But for the time being, these angels are just too dangerous. They are chained up until this time of judgment. Now, there is a verse that says that you and I shall judge angels, is there not? And you might think, well, do the righteous angels need much judgment? Maybe, but perhaps our judgment will be of these angels at some point. I guess I don't know for sure, but we turn to 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 18. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 18. And here we read, for Christ also suffered once for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit, by which also he went and preached to the spirits in prison, who formerly were disobedient, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight souls, were saved by water. So, it's one of those slightly tricky verses, but it does tell us here in verse 19 that Jesus went and preached or proclaimed to the spirits in prison. Now, some people say, oh, there you are. That's dead people in some place. And Jesus went there and preached to these dead people about his resurrection or something. Well, spirits in prison, we just read about them. The angels that sinned, that left their first domain, are chained up in Tartarus, in prison. You know, human beings are never called spirits. And I think we all know that when a human being dies, you know, they are, you know, dead. Just like Rover, they're dead all over. So you're not going to preach to dead folk because there's nothing to preach at. But there are fallen angels, there are rebellious angels who are chained up in prison. It says here, verse 19, the timing here looks like verse 18 says that Jesus died, then he was made alive. Obviously, his resurrection, this sort of implies that having been resurrected, you know, back to life, he then went and preached to the spirits in prison who formerly were disobedient. So when was this all about? When did this take place? Who formerly were disobedient, rebelled in other words, when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah. So it looks like this particular rebellion that's being alluded to here took place way back prior to the flood. And Jesus went and, you know, preached to them about what's going to come. And it seems like the particular rebellion, the disobedience, was way back formerly when the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah. And if you think about the days of Noah, remember what happened? The whole earth was put to death, apart from Noah, his wife, three sons, and their wives. And some people have estimated that maybe about a billion people on the earth in those days. Now, why would God exterminate approximately 1 billion people? Well, hint here is that these particular angels who rebelled had been in some way responsible for what took place. Remember, we read in Genesis that every imagination of man's heart was only evil continually. I mean, can you imagine that? Every imagination of man's heart was only evil continually. We're talking about a type of, you know, iniquity that is almost beyond comprehension. Apart from the fact it says, as it was in the days of Noah, it will be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. So we may say repeat performance, but here we're talking about potentially these angels were so implicated in man's wickedness that God couldn't allow it to happen again, and these angels have been imprisoned. Can't leave them loose. They were implicated in man's destruction at the flood. Now, speculation, it was Fred Coulter, I've taken a little cowbell and ring it now, because there's a possibility they may be released in the future to cause further problems. Look at Revelation chapter 9. So, ding, 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 little bell ringing there. Revelation chapter 9, talking of the various trumpets. And remember, by the way, 3 weeks from today is the Feast of Trumpets. But talking of the trumpets and what they mean, this passage in Revelation 9 has always been tricky to sort of fully grasp. And there's another possible explanation relating to these angels who are in prison and who may have been responsible for the wickedness prior to the flood. Revelation 9:1, then the fifth angel sounded his trumpet, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to the earth, and to him was given the key to the bottomless pit. So here's a good angel. He's given a key to the bottomless pit, or to the shaft of the abyss. You've got the abyss, which is somewhere deep, deep, deep. There's a shaft or a well leading down to it, and obviously it's locked. So this angel, this good angel, is given a key to unlock this shaft leading down to this abyss. What's in the abyss? He opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke, locusts came upon the earth. Now, this is where a bit of speculation. We've often said this might be like locusts being used to picture the Assyrians, because in Nahum and so on, you can see the Assyrian army likened to locusts. They all jostle together, they get spears and so on, and they sort of run together and clank together, and they destroy things like locusts do. And maybe locusts means Assyria, maybe. It's a sort of an attempt to try and understand. But another understanding is that this is fairly literal. The abyss is opened up, and these strange creatures come out. Now the smoke locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. They were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth, or any green thing, or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God in their foreheads. In other words, most of the earth they can harm. And they were told not, they were not given authority to kill, but to torment them for 5 months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes down. What is this? What we're talking about here? If it's a strange type of spirit being out of the abyss, then we would struggle. We're trying to find some military weaponry that the Germans might use. We can speculate, but even that, of course, is speculation. In those days, verse 6, men will seek death and will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. And the shape of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were crowns of something like gold. Their faces were like faces of men. They had hair like women's hair, and their teeth were like lion's teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. Now, maybe this is military used by Germany. Maybe this is demons, spirit beings released from the abyss. They had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. They had as a king over them the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he has the name Apollyon. So they have a commander, a king, who is the angel from the bottomless pit. Well, that's not going to be Satan, because he's not in the bottomless pit. So here we have These potentially are demon spirits, rather horrific sounding ones, who have a king over them from the bottomless pit, and he's called Destroyer in Hebrew and Greek. So it could be that the troubles at the very end of this age are going to be, you know, supernaturally bad. If this passage here, underline if, it's speculative, but if this is talking about these spirits who are currently chained, and if they or similar are to be released from the abyss at the end time, then they're going to cause, you know, an amazing amount of destruction that man has never seen before on the earth. And so let's finish in 1 Peter 5:8. So we've been through a number of different scriptures today, talking about Satan, adversary, enemy. Don't be unaware of his devices. Let him not exploit, take advantage of us. We've seen that we've got warfare against principalities, powers, rulers, spiritual wickedness in high places. We've seen how the demons, unclean spirits, have troubled people in the past. Epilepsy, deafness, dumbness, people being bowed over for 18 years. We've seen how they can interfere with the messages from God's angels, like and Gabriel in the days of Daniel. So there's plenty out there. We need to be aware of that spirit realm and be on our guard. So let's close today on 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, where Peter says, for very good reasons, he says, be sober, be vigilant. Martin says, be watchful. Hopefully we can understand why. The spirit realm is a big, busy, active place, and we can't afford just to sleepwalk through it. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, your enemy, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Let's hope that's not you and me. As it says in verse 9, resist him, steadfast in the faith. Okay, brethren, we'll continue with that next week, and look more at how we do combat Satan. But for now, we'll conclude our Bible study.